Because the classical rotation is what it is. I once said to someone, I had a vision of someday teaching a loving kindness retreat where we only take one person as the object, as the recipient, and the part of them that we really admire, they're like our benefactor, and the part of them or parts of them we feel comfortable with, they're like our friend. The parts of them we don't know, they're like our neutral person. The parts of them we don't like that much, they're like our difficult person. And the person I was talking to said, well, you know, we can just choose ourselves, actually, which is true. So we utilize that structure of the categories, but it's not like an absolute truth. Because life is so complex and intricate and changeable and varied, but we just use it as a way to continually unfold the process and to challenge ourselves and open ourselves in different ways. So relating to difficult experience, which could include difficult parts of ourselves, difficult people, adverse circumstance, not getting what we want. And just think for a moment, what are the less skillful ways you might personally find yourself approaching these things? Just see what comes to mind. What does your extra dukkha tend to look like? Of course, it will likely be more than one thing, but sometimes we have a kind of favorite. Shame, fear, bitterness, anger, feeling we should have been able to stop it, should have more control than this, feeling isolated, maybe all of the above. And also look at your experience and maybe a particular circumstance or ordeal will come to mind, but think of a time when you feel you were with a difficulty, maybe with more compassion for yourself or for others, or less of a sense of being defined by it. This is the only thing I will ever feel. And just see what comes to mind. And which particulars of the relationship were there to that difficulty. So that's an interesting little thought experiment, isn't it? Because that response makes a big difference. One's mind state makes a big difference. And one of the, a lot of the remedies really have to do with moving beyond that thought, we should be in control. We should be able to control everything. And absent that, we have room to really think, well, what can I do? So the resolution isn't to be passive or just to kind of take it, whatever it is, but to see if we can be moving forward from a different place. So when I talked about the distinction between remorse and guilt, that's one of those distinctions. You can have tremendous intention to be different to the best of your ability, but it doesn't necessarily have to come out of that definition of yourself as like a despicable person. It could have a very different kind of energy to it. You could take a very strong stand about something, but it doesn't necessarily have to come from a place of just disdain for others. So we're always kind of looking at our reaction. It's like, how do I feel about this? And looking at our intention. What do I want most out of this encounter, situation, whatever it might be? And we look at things like the quality, the flavor, the nature of a reactive place like anger, and see its strengths, see its weaknesses, see the detriment that comes. And when we talk about things like that, it's not a question of what we feel. I mean, we feel what we feel. And here is one of the great lessons about control. I feel like it's one of those things for myself that, you know how sometimes you learn the same thing again and again and again and again, hopefully on a deeper level all the time. So, you know, as I said, when I first started my practice, I was very self-critical. I was very judgmental, and that was a thread that remained for a good long time. And a part of that was the riff I've been repeating. You know, I shouldn't feel this anymore. I should have been able to stop this. I've been practicing for like 3 hours. I shouldn't have this anymore. I've been practicing for 20 years. I shouldn't have this anymore. I've been practicing for 40 years. I shouldn't have this anymore. And one of the great gifts one of my teachers, this man named Indra, gave to me was really right around that point. So when I was practicing with him, and I can think of repeated times, one of the kinds of things he would say to me would be, "Why are you so upset about this thought that has come up in your mind? Did you invite it? Did you say at 1:30, I'd like to be filled with self-hatred, please?" No. But we react to it as though we had done exactly that. It's all my fault that I feel this, that I think this. So that's kind of extraneous, that sort of blame, because things arise when conditions come together for them to arise. That doesn't mean we can't affect those conditions. We are always working on affecting those conditions, but we will never have that kind of supreme control. Like, I decided I'm never going to be afraid again. I've grieved long enough. I will never fall asleep meditating again. We can affect those conditions, but maybe it's 105 degrees and you're in Burma instead of Seattle. And you just had what is your last meal of the day at 10:30 in the morning, and it was what it was, and so you're really sleepy. When conditions come together for something to arise, it will arise. So imagine recapturing all that energy that we might normally expend in blaming ourselves and actually changing our relationship to the thing, whatever it is. So to say we don't have absolute control about what will come up doesn't mean that we're just going to give in to everything that comes up. But feelings, thoughts, experiences are born of so many conditions coming together. We're just not able to decide, okay, now I'm free of that forever. It'll never come up again. If it comes up, we can deal with it, right? We have skills, we have tools. And so it's a different kind of relationship. So none of this is about whether we should feel anger or not, or we should feel a certain thing or not. It's understanding that when we are overcome by certain feelings, especially when they are strong enough to drive us to action, then they are consequential. And it's before that moment in time, before we've sent the email, that we want to have enough space to see an array of options. Right? So when anger is talked about, it's not like the fleeting feeling or the fact that it arose. It's because it's very consequential when we are defined by it. So remember, there are those two not so skillful relationships to all of our experience. One is getting consumed by it, overwhelmed by it, defined by it without any space, without any sense of being centered. That's like hearing the knock at the door from that visiting force and opening the door and saying, "Welcome home, it's all yours." Right? Instead of realizing this is something that's coming and going. This is an impermanent force. This is a visitor. So maybe we get overwhelmed. I'm such an angry person and I always will be. Or this is the only thing I will ever feel. Or first I'm going to do this vengeful thing, then I'm going to do that vengeful thing, then I'm going to do that one, then I'm going to totally destroy them by doing this. Right? Without any kind of sense of space or centeredness. And of course the other not so helpful relationship is the energetic opposite, which is I'm so bad, I'm so terrible, I shouldn't feel this. No one else ever feels this. Or, you know, this has gone on for too long, it shouldn't be here anymore, and we try to deny and repress. And, it really doesn't help. So what we're looking for is that place in the middle where we completely recognize what's going on. We're connected to it, we're not overwhelmed by it, and we're not denying it or pushing it away. We're not in struggle against it. And that's the place where the options appear, that's the place where the learning happens. So what is said to be the nature of anger? Especially when we're kind of in it, right? It's taken over in some way. The Buddhist psychology talks about anger as being like a forest fire, which burns up its own support. It's something that can leave us devastated, right? It burns up its own support. It can be very damaging to us. And like a fire, it can burn really wild, so we might end up in a place very far from where we want to be. The positive part of anger is the energy of it. It's not a passive state, it's not a complacent state. It's something people draw on a lot to say no, to have a boundary. It's got a kind of cutting through energy. Like anger can propel us to cut through social niceties and kind of group dynamics of avoidance. You know how sometimes it's like really the angry person at a meeting or in a room that will say, look at the color of that tape, that's the wrong color. And everyone else is kind of looking the other way and not wanting to pay any attention to it. It's like, just cuts through, right? So that's actually a very positive aspect of it, that cutting through energy. But the negativity, the burning, the wildness, the fact that it can destroy us, that it can lead us to be very far from where we want to be, that's what makes it such an unskillful state to be acting from. You know, so in some ways, some approaches would say, well, what we want to do is capture that energy, to be able to utilize the energy and really make it that kind of cutting through process rather than getting lost in all the rest. And again, this is not about what we feel. It's about almost like what we nurture, what we cultivate, what we allow to drive us into action. So anger is like a forest fire that burns up its own support. It also has a very distinct quality of kind of tunnel vision. It really narrows our options. If you think about, and you can bring it up right now, the last time you were really angry at yourself. I don't know when that was, but just bring it back. It is not likely to also be a time when you think, you know what? I was really stupid, I did that, and that very same morning, I did 5 good things. Right? Those 5 good things, they're gone. They've just been wiped out. All that's left is our reality, is that stupid thing we said or did. So we lose a lot of information, perspective, understanding, when we're just lost in that sense of anger. The story that I've told for years, which still works, is about this time. It was very, very early days of email. And I was at home in Barre, Massachusetts, working on my desktop computer. I was doing something or other, and then I went to check my email, and I had an email. It was like so exciting. And so I read the email. It was from a friend, and he wrote something like, I don't understand what the problem is with anger. And again, we're not talking about what we feel. We're talking about getting enveloped in, you know, really lost in a state. So he said, I don't understand what the problem is with anger. So I wrote back and I said, well, one of the problems with being really lost in anger is that then we tend to put people in a box. And I got offline, and then I went back to my project, whatever I was doing. And something went terribly wrong in the relationship between my computer and my printer, and I got really angry. The first person I was angry at, we didn't even have the phrase IT then. We used to call him our computer assistant. I was really angry at our computer assistant because he was in Hawaii on vacation. And I was furious. You know, how can he not be here when I need him? You know, doesn't he know? And what was so interesting was that in being lost in that anger, I totally forgot that the reason he was on vacation was because I had decided he needed a vacation. And I had gone to the airport and used my frequent flyer miles to get him a ticket. Right? But that was gone. He's now not here when I need him. And then I was really angry at myself. I thought, why can't you be the kind of person who can fix these things? And I was down on my hands and knees, and I was like pulling out plugs, and I was putting in other plugs, and I thought, you are so inept, you can't do anything. And then in the midst of all that, I fixed it. But I hardly even like took a moment to appreciate that. I was just so grumbly, you know, so I got back on my chair and went back to working on my project. And then at some point, I went back online. And there was my friend writing, saying, I don't understand what you mean by saying that when we're lost in anger, we just put people in a box. And so I wrote to him and I said, this is what I just did. You know, I put this guy in a box, like, you're never here when I need you. I put myself in a box, you can't fix anything. It's just the nature. It's like this squeezing down energy. It's a big tunnel vision when we're lost in that state. And some schools or perspectives in Buddhist psychology will say anger and fear are the same state. They're just two forms of the same state, anger being the expressive, energized form, fear being the held-in, frozen form of striking out against what's happening, wanting to declare it to be untrue. So I think it is very valuable to appreciate that kind of cutting through energy, to understand just the sheer energy of that state, and also to understand that it is so destructive to have it rule our choices, our relationships, our encounters, that we really do want to find another way to use the energy of it and not be so lost in it. And that, you know, classically would be around mindfulness, and it would be around loving kindness as an antidote. And so that brings up, of course, the very interesting question of, isn't loving kindness being kind of like a doormat and saying you're not going to be strong about anything, you're not going to take a stand on anything? And so, I mean, experientially we answer that by experiencing it and realizing, no, it's not that way at all. And we can also explore it in lots of different dimensions. What is the energy that you draw on when you have made a mistake and you need to go on? And you want to be different? What's the most helpful energy? What's the energy you want to extend to your child or a child? It's not weakness, right? It's not like run in traffic once a lot, you know, I'm being kind. You know, there are like very clear boundaries perhaps and parameters for behavior. But the correction doesn't have to be coming from a place of rejection, right? Or hatred. It's coming from really a sense of compassion, which can be very strong. And so usually we talk about the distinction between the motivation behind an action and the skillful execution of the action. All right, I'll just use the clock as my prop. So the motivation or the intention behind an action in something like the Buddhist psychology is considered really a crucial, critical part of the action. This is a little different than in the West, where we might more commonly say, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, or what do you mean you had a good intention? You screwed up. But in the East, the intention or the motivation behind an action is considered a very powerful component of the action. When you're trying to look at your own integrity, how well you've done, that's the first thing you look at. So, for example, if I was to reach down and pick up this clock and hand it to one of you, all anybody sees is my hand moving down, picking up an object and moving it forward. What's the heart space that's generating that? Why am I doing that? I could be offering it to you because I like you and I want you to have it. I could be offering it to you because I just gave a whole big talk on generosity and I want everyone to think I'm a really generous person. I could be offering it to you because I see you have that really great looking water bottle and I think, well, hey, you know, maybe I'll give you the alarm clock and you'll give me the water bottle. Maybe I'm giving it to you because I don't like you and it says Nalanda West right on it, you know, and I'm going to think, haha, they're going to think you stole it. You know, but it's like the same gesture, it could be the same smile on my face, but the action is coming from a completely different place inside. And so we use mindfulness continually to try to notice where we're coming from. This is what I said earlier. One way of doing it is to think before an encounter, a meeting, something like that, what do I really want to see happen from this? It's just one avenue in to get a sense of what your motivation might be. And it's said both in current research and in the text that the arena of the psyche, of the mind, that is very powerfully affected by a practice like loving kindness is the arena of motivation or intention. It may not determine what we'll do, it'll help determine why we do it. So when I said yesterday that, and then again today a little bit, that loving kindness is considered the antidote to fear, if we have been coming largely from a place of fear, motivating what we do and what we say, and we do a practice like loving kindness, we will find we're coming from a different place. And it's not because we're forcing ourselves, it's not because we're giving ourselves a lecture, it's not because you're thinking, damn, I spent the whole weekend, you know, supposedly cultivating loving kindness, why better respond in this way? That shift happens so that we find we're coming from a place of connection and care as a field of motivation. So that's the first aspect of the action. The second aspect of the action, you could call like the skillful or unskillful execution of the action. You know, so maybe out of a beautiful motive, I pick up the alarm clock to give to one of you, and then I might think, you know what, there's only one. Maybe this is the kind of thing best done privately. Maybe it wouldn't be that good to steal this alarm clock. Maybe I should go out and buy an alarm clock and give it to you. Right? It's like a mindfulness in a bigger sense, mindfulness of context. What is this particular moment in time, this situation, this context seem to call for in terms of skillful action? Sometimes I call it our best guess of what will be most skillful in a certain situation at a certain time. And the reason that we talk about this so much is because these are two distinct elements of an action. There's the motivation, and then there's the kind of discernment, you could say, the skillfulness or unskillfulness of the execution of the action. If we conflate them, if they seem like one thing to us, then that's a place where people sometimes say, oh, you know, were I to have a more loving heart, I could only say yes. I could only smile. I could only be sweet. But truthfully, we might come from a genuinely loving and compassionate place, and our best guess in a certain moment, in a certain context, of the most skillful way to act can be pretty fierce. It's saying no. It's drawing a line. It's being quite intense and clear. It's not all meek and mild, right? So they're actually two, they're obviously connected, but they're two distinct uses and approaches, and we need them both. We might well cultivate a deep well of loving kindness and compassion, and in a certain situation, because of whatever discernment, our best guess of what's most appropriate, we do say no. No, I'm not letting you move in. I'm not doing this. Right? And this is very, very important to keep understanding and emphasizing. So we're not talking about, you know, some particular weird model of what a loving person might say or do. We're talking about the genuine heart space of connection and care. And then using intelligence, wisdom, discernment, mindfulness in this bigger way to open up our field of possibility. And when I say we have options when we're mindful, this is part of it. Right? We're so habituated maybe to lash out, send that email right away. So what happens when we take a purposeful pause? And we read the email again, and we breathe. And then we decide, well, you know what? Maybe that's not the most skillful way of expressing my needs. Maybe I'm less likely to get what I want said in this way. Okay, so this is also an important understanding. And again, the kind of bottom line is a lot about compassion for ourselves. You know, when, I don't even want to say this because it's like a curse on myself, but when the airline loses your luggage, since I'm flying tomorrow, I'll let you all know if it actually, you know, when the airline loses your luggage, how much suffering are you adding to the experience by losing it? You know, like losing your mind, being overwhelmed by anger and bitterness and rage. Which is not to say you don't do anything, right? You do everything you can do and you're as strong as you can be. But it doesn't necessarily need to come from that place, which is just, it's you being overwhelmed. You feeling powerless and reaching out for some way of a feeling you have an option. So the story I usually tell these days, I don't know if any of you work for Verizon. But I live in Massachusetts, as I keep saying, and I also, for some years, I've had a little sublet apartment in New York City, and I spend chunks of time there, travel from there, and so on. So last summer, I had to leave the apartment that I'd been in for many, many years and find a new apartment for a number of different reasons. And finding a new apartment meant Verizon. I need a landline phone, like an old-fashioned phone, because I do a fair amount of radio interviews on the phone and they always want a landline for broadcast quality. And I need a high-speed internet access because I live online. So I finally got an apartment, which was not easy. I finally got a date with Verizon, which was not right away. And the happy day came when Verizon was supposed to arrive and install my phone and my high-speed internet access. So it was a whole series of crazy circumstances, and finally this guy showed up and he said, "I'm here to install your phone." And I said, "Well, what about the internet access?" And he said, "Oh, I don't do that. I just do phones, because not that many people want a landline anymore." So he installed the phone, which worked for a total of 7 hours. But that's another story. And then I had to call Verizon and say, "Where's my internet?" So that sounds easier than it is. You know, so it's hours later, like calling. Before I speak to a human being. So I've been in the apartment at this point for like 6 hours. And I was afraid to leave. There was like no food, you know. And I get on the phone with someone from Verizon and I said, "I don't know what happened to this guy who was supposed to install my internet." So she looks up some things and she said, "Well, the technician says you sent him away." And I said, "That's insane." I said, "You don't know me. There is nothing I want in the world more than high-speed internet access." I said, "I am online all the time." And I said, "I have been sitting in this apartment for 6 hours, you know, like." And she said something like, "Could there be someone else in your apartment to send him away?" And I said, "No, I mean, it's like an itty-bitty little apartment, you know, like barely an apartment." I said, "There's no one else here, and that's just crazy." And I said, "When can he come?" And I said, "It's so clear he went to the wrong apartment. You know, it's so obvious that's what happened." And I said, "When can he come back?" And she was kind of grumbly, and she said, like, "Give me a minute or something." And she came back, and she told me a date that was, like, almost 2 months away, something like that. And I said, "That's awful, you know? Like, I said, why is that so long? Why is that so long?" And she said something like, "You're lucky I could get you an appointment at all, because now you're on the list." And I said, what list? And she said, basically, like crazy people who call Verizon for no reason and then send the technician away. It's like a false alarm and a fire or something like that. And I was like, I said, that's insane. He went to the wrong apartment. But, you know, I wasn't giving up that appointment. And maybe an hour later, something like that, I get a call because the phone's still working. And it's the technician. And he said, I made a mistake. I went to the wrong apartment. Could I come tomorrow? And I said, yes. Which was really great, because then the phone stopped working. You know, but there were a lot of opportunities in that just to demonize somebody. The technician, who turned out to be just a human being who made a mistake and could actually admit it and try to do something about it. The people I was talking to, I felt, obviously, I was really unseen. I thought, don't you know, like, I'm a good person? Do you want character references? You know, like, I would never, like, just randomly call Verizon and then send the technician away. You know, so, and that's a pretty terrible feeling, isn't it, when we feel misunderstood or unseen in some way. So, I mean, I could have just been overwhelmed with distress about that. But, you know, there's the wisdom of a lot of years of practice. It's bad enough not to have the internet, and then the phone dies. But where is the majority of the suffering going to come from? Really, it usually comes from feeling so alienated from everybody and so hateful or frightened or bitter, so personally selected by the universe for trouble, so isolated, so cut off, and more cut off than not having a phone or an internet service. It's just the power of training. It's not a pleasant experience. And I wouldn't say I dealt with it perfectly, but I also know so deeply where happiness lies and where, like, that extra dukkha lies. And it's actually not in the circumstance, most commonly. Circumstance might be really bad, and, you know, it could be truly terrible, and sometimes it is. But on top of that, it's like we can spare ourselves all the rest. You know, the agitation, the lashing out, the incredible stress, and all of that. So that's the opportunity that is available to us. And it is really, honestly, I think it's a question of training. These are all nice ideas, but to make them real, especially in adverse circumstance, we need to practice. I just wrote a foreword for someone's book, and I told this story in the foreword about this time when I was interviewed by Good Housekeeping magazine, which is a hoot. I mean, if you'd ever seen my house. But it wasn't about decor or cleanliness. I mean, I'm clean, I'm just messy. I'm always packing, you know, I'm packing. The question the interviewer asked me, and as it turned out, they never included my comments in the interview, but the question he asked me was, how do you use mindfulness or meditation in a time of complete crisis? And I said in response, I wouldn't wait. You know, sometimes we do wait, and everything's falling apart, and things are really bad, and that's when people reach for some alternative way of being. And even then, perhaps it's somewhat supportive. But we don't need to wait. It's like we're building that muscle, that capacity, the resilience factor, the ability to let go and start over, to forgive ourselves, to see change and the possibilities within change. We're building it like every day in an ordinary sitting, however bad it or meaningless or boring it might seem, that's what we're building. And then when we need it, it's there. So that's the point. It's an actual training. And that's hard for us. You know, it's much easier to think fondly about the possibility of being there, or, you know, talk about it. Or when my book Real Happiness came out, which is this guide to establishing a meditation practice, there were any number of people that came up to me to ask me to sign the book, and they'd say, "I'm buying your book for my cousin." I could never do this. And I'd say, "Well, nice for the cousin, and thank you for buying it, but are you sure? You know, what's that habit of procrastination or deflection, or, you know, it works for someone else, or I think that's a great idea for you?" Or, you know, when the important thing is making it real. It's actually doing it. And that's why I really say do it every day. Really practice, 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 because when we need it, that's how it will most easily be there. It's not to say it won't be there. You know, those qualities of mindfulness and compassion, they may be there in a time of complete crisis anyway, but why not, as I said earlier, why not do something in the easiest way possible rather than the hardest way possible, which is like wait till it's like so tough and then say, "Oh, I think I'll try practicing a little mindfulness." You know, we have that ability to really just strengthen those qualities each and every day, an ordinary day. And then it is so much easier to have access to them in times of great adversity. So I'm going to suggest we do some walking practice in loving kindness. Is there anyone who needs some instruction in that? Okay, so in doing walking practice in loving kindness, rather than centering our attention on the feeling of sensations in movement, we continue to center our attention lightly on the repetition of certain phrases. So it's eyes open, walk at a normal pace. You can even go over there because you're going to look normal. And as you're walking, see if you can have a light attention on the repetition of the phrases. And again, there are many varieties and many ways of doing it. The way I like to do it, and you may, three or four phrases might be too many given the complexity of also being aware of everything that's going on around you and so on. But if you maybe have two phrases, let's just say, and I would suggest using as a baseline the phrases for yourself. So as you're walking along, you're gently resting your attention on phrases like, "May I be happy, may I be peaceful. May I be happy, be peaceful. Be happy, be peaceful." Direct it toward yourself. And then when someone comes strongly into your consciousness, you hear a bird, you hear a dog, you see a person come by or drive by, or somebody pops into your head from home, just for a few moments, you include them like, "Oh, be happy." And then you continue on with the walking and the phrases for yourself. So it's eyes open, walk at a normal pace, the silent repetition of certain phrases, and just a light awareness. You're not trying to block out everything else, but you just have this touchstone as you walk, okay? So we're going to take about 35 minutes.